Excision number 22675, reel 1.
Des Crowden, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born on the 8th of December 1920 in Pemberton Road, East Molesey, which is about a mile from Hampton Court Palace.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in East Molesey?
Yes, I did, at Park Road, East Molesey, which was the road next to where I lived. And when I was 14, I went to Kingston Technical College. I shouldn't have gone there. You know, I do much better writing rather than using my hands, and still do. But I went there because my father was an engineer, my brother was an engineer, and they thought I should be an engineer. But I hated the workshop.
How old were you when you finished your education?
When I finished my education, I would have been 16.
So that would have been 36?
Yeah.
Did you get a job?
Oh, yes. Yeah, jobs were plentiful. In fact, I went to work with a company named Western Electric, who were based on the Kingston Bypass, which is not far from here, so I was able to cycle to work. Unfortunately, after a few years, they amalgamated with a firm in Enfield called Sangamo, and the whole shooting match moved to Enfield. We were invited to go, but although I was about to tour half the world in those days, we didn't like the idea of leaving home. So I walked down the road about a mile and got another job with a company whose name I forget, but they were making by then ammunition boxes for Blenheim bombers. And I enjoyed that, and I had a very good mate there. Unfortunately, during one tea break, I was taking the rise out of him, and he got fed up with it, and he threw his tea over me. I still had a mug of tea, chased him. When we got to two big swing doors, I let fly with my tea. Unfortunately, at that moment, three men from the ministry walked in with the manager and were splashed with the tea. They all had umbrellas, but of course, being indoors, none of them were up. I was sacked on the spot. At that point, I decided to join the army, against my parents' wishes. They had seen the First World War and wasn't keen for me to go in the army. But being young, like everybody else, I wanted to join the forces. So when I'd got the money they owed me and my P-45 and my stamp card, which you had in those days, I circled to Kingston, which was about 3 miles away, to a barracks, which is along the Portsmouth Road at Kingston, and there they were recruiting for the army. And there was a splendid looking recruiting sergeant outside, complete with red sash, and parked my bike and went over to him and said, I would like some information about the army. He said, you're lucky, because you're volunteering today, you've got a choice of 6 regiments. Now, fortunately, one of those regiments was the Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire Regiment, and my family had moved down from Hertfordshire, and I thought that might placate them. So I went in and decided to join up, elected to join the Beds and Hearts, and was told that I would get another notification asking me to come back for a medical. I asked the recruiting sergeant when he thought that would be, and he said it would be in about a month's time. 2 days later, I was requested to go for the medical, and 2 days after that, I got my rail warrant and my pass to go to Cranfield Aerodrome, where people who had joined the army went into young soldiers' battalions and did guards and helped in the cookhouse and jobs like that. That was June 1940, at the time of Dunkirk. It was a beautiful summer, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I only got into trouble once. Being young, I decided to play a prank on the orderly sergeant. All the NCOs were people who'd been in the First World War and were recalled to do jobs such as training recruits. And one night when he was doing roll call, incidentally, we were living in former civvy billets. The wives of airmen lived there, but they took them out when the war started, and so we had very comfortable billets. And when he came around that night, I hid under the bed. I was put on the charger course, marched in, given 7 days CB, so I was the only one who couldn't go out to Bedford Town, very nice town, and that was my start of my army career.
How did you take to army life?
I enjoyed it. I think it was, being young, I enjoyed it. The food wasn't bad on that station. Being RAF, you know, I think the food was a little better than you get in the barracks. So I enjoyed the excitement. In fact, two friends came to see me and I talked both of them into joining up. Both joined the Air Force.
What terms had you signed on for?
Simply for the duration of the war.
Had the war affected you before that?
Not at all. We'd had, like everybody else, the first scare on the Sunday that war was declared, but no German planes turned up. And we hadn't had any bombing around there then. As most people know, the first 6 months of the war was a very quiet period. Nothing was happening, apart from troops, of course, going to France. But I hadn't reached that stage.
What? So you were in the 70th Battalion, were you?
I was, yes.
What are your next memories?
We did a lot of guards, of course, and had a look at people's passes as they went out and came in. We saw one German aeroplane during that period. Another British plane crashed close to the camp and everyone was killed, and the memory was of all the ammunition going on. And the only other thing I can remember was meeting a girl there in Bedford Town, which was quite pleasant, but I didn't continue with that relationship. And the only other thing was I thought, as I was about to be shot at, I thought I would get confirmed in the Church of England, which I did, and was confirmed by the Bishop of Bedford in Bedford Cathedral. And soon after that, that was about 6 months later, I'd finished my initial training and then unfortunately was moved to the headquarters of the Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire Regiment, which was a large barracks in Bedford Town, Kempston Barracks in fact. And I didn't like it at all because I was sleeping in a room with 29 other people. In the morning you had to fight for a tap to get a wash, and doing plenty of guards. And I decided one night when I was on guard that I would try and get moved somewhere else. And that particular night, a German plane came over, and I was looking at passes with a torch, and I don't know whether it was my torch that attracted the Luftwaffe, but they let go a bomb. It landed in the field just outside the barracks, killed two cows, and that was the only damage they caused. In the morning when I came off duty, something took me to the notice board to look at all the notices, and there in black and white was a message which said, soldiers wanted for special training for special service units. I immediately put my name down and talked a friend of mine into coming with me. The interview was about 3 days later. I went in first and was interviewed by a commando officer who'd come down, presumably from Scotland, and interviewed me. It was quite an extensive interview, and luckily I was selected for that far, to go training in the Commando Training Centre in Scotland to see if I matched up to the stringent tests you went through, although they're nothing like those experienced now by Royal Marine Commandos, where fortunately I go every year for about 5 days. However, I passed the test, came out and was told I'd hear in about another 3 days and get a rail warrant to go to Scotland. When I came out of the interview, my friend was missing. I tracked him down. By then it was tea time when you had a piece of bread and jam and a cup of tea, and said, "What happened to you?" He said, "Well, it's very dangerous. I'm a married man, you're not, so I decided not to go through with it." I was disappointed, but about 3 days later, with my warrant and pass, I got on a train at Bedford, which took me to Glasgow Station, where I caught another train which went into the mountains. And there I was at a place called Achterloo in Scotland. There were two places where commandos were trained, Achterloo and a few miles Achnacarry. But Achterloo was the only one open at that time. And we spent about 6 weeks there, nothing like the training now, where they spend about 10 months at a place called Limpston in Devon. I don't know how they get through it, although recently they've lessened the demands because they're not getting enough recruits. I went up there before we arrived in Speen Bridge, that was the name of the station. The train didn't pull into the station. I think it was part of the test. We had to jump out on the track and walk to the station where lorries were ready to take us to this training centre at Akdulu.
Why had you volunteered for commandos in the first place?
Well, I wanted to get away from the barrack room atmosphere in Bedfordshire, at the Bedfordshire and Hart depot. I suppose if I'd have stayed there, I'd joined a battalion and gone elsewhere, but my friend who deserted me at the wrong moment probably ended up in the desert and got killed, or even in the jungle where I ended up. So, being young, if it's something new, you'd like to have a go at it, you were told stories about it, so I wanted to try it.
At this stage in 1940, had you got the impression that the Germans were going to win the war?
No, I don't think we would ever think that. You know, we would win the war. That's what we were there for. Never gave it a thought.
So you arrived at Speen Bridge. What yeah. happened then?
Well, we were taken by lorries to Akdulu. There was snow on the mountains because it was January. Water was flowing down from the mountains, and when we went out on route marches, we always stopped near one of those to drink the water out of cupped hands. We went through it. In fact, it may be quite well known that during the training of commandos during the whole of war, 40 recruits were killed in training, mostly through accidents, because often you did a landing on the side of a lock under fire, live fire, and so 40 people died. No one died in my little outfit, and included going up into the mountains where we had snow up into our heads, learning to cook in the open, sleeping rough, many route marches, some forced marches, which are quite exhausting, and almost every day some have failed a test and were immediately sent back to their unit. It was called RTU, Return to Unit. But about 40 of us survived. And at the end of the period, we were on parade, congratulated by the commanding officer. All the trainers were there for this parade. And then you were split up into commandos where they needed recruits. And commandos always seemed to be needing recruits. Although up to that stage, there had only been small commando landings, nothing of note, and very few casualties. So the units were read out, and I was told that I was destined to join Number 5 Commando, who weren't far away. We were always in civvy billets, which was great. I was told to join 5 Commando in a place called Barhead, or Bardheed, as the Scots would say, and that is just beyond Paisley. So I joined and was met on arrival by a lance corporal who took me to my billet, which was a house owned by a lovely Scots lady. Never remember seeing her husband, probably she hadn't got one. And she took me upstairs to my room, and in the room was a very comfortable bed, but not only that, a coal fire. Now I'd just come from roughing it, and that was marvellous, having a coal fire. Next morning at breakfast, it deteriorated a bit because I was given a steaming bowl of porridge, dug into it straight away, that was the first course, and found there was salt in it. Being a soft southerner, I was used to sugar. So, you know, that was an eye-opener. We didn't stay in Barhead very long. In fact, it was only about 4 days. I enjoyed that short stay. We were then put on a train one evening, not knowing where we were destined for. Almost the whole of Barhead was out there because by then, several romances had built up, and one or two chaps had got married to Scots girls, and they were all there to say goodbye. It was quite a rousing send-off. We got on this train, and we disappeared into the night. Our first stop was at Bristol, where we had breakfast on the station, and then the train pulled up out again, and we eventually landed in Falmouth, a wonderful town, a place I still love, for more reason than one. When we got out of the train, we were marshalled in the station car park, where the adjutant addressed us, And I found part of his address quite embarrassing, because he told us, reminded us, that we were now in a seaport where there would be a few undesirable girls, and if anyone got VD, they would be returned to their unit. I couldn't believe it because, you know, people were standing close by. We then formed up in our troops. I was in five troop, five commando, and marched to different points in the town. The place area we went to was Old Hill in Falmouth. And Falmouth, almost every road is a hill, which is a great place for training because not only has it got all these hills, but they're lovely beaches for swimming and doing unarmed combat. There are cliffs for climbing, plenty of boating. So it seemed to me to be the ideal place. Now, we were told, and I don't know whether it's true at all, but we were down there to embark for the Azores because Winston Churchill wanted to borrow the Azores just for the war years. And the story was, and it may be a tall story, was that there was a pub near the Portuguese embassy, Portuguese only Azores, where members of the embassy staff used to drink in the evenings. And an army officer was sent in there, a British army officer, who was supposed to be under the influence to drink, and he was there for one purpose, to leak this news that the Azores were going to be annexed. And the outcome was, of course, that the embassy notified the government in Portugal, who apparently gave Churchill permission to use it for berthing and, you know, any troop ships or merchant ships or the Navy in trouble with U-boats. Now, that's what we were told. I don't know how truth it was. But we were there for a wonderful 11 months, and we went up to Falmouth Castle to use their firing range. And we used to do speed marches to Truro, which was just under 12 miles. They were exhausting. And we used to go across the water for Flushing, where there's plenty of hilly open ground for training. So we were very well trained. And then, early in 1942, and we used to do lots of night schemes, of course. Early in 1942, we were taken out for a 48-hour march. And when we were finished that, and we were all pretty shattered, we were lined up, and who should turn up but a very famous commando, Lord Lovett. And he inspected us, and two things I remember about him. He was wearing a Lovett green battle dress, obviously made by his tailor, and he was smelling of something which we'd never smelt before, aftershave or some perfume of some kind. We weren't impressed. He wasn't impressed with us because he told us, you know, being on a march for 48 hours was nothing really, you know, there was worse to come. Now, we learnt later that another reason he was there was, this was early 1942, of course, that was to see how we behaved because some of our people would be required for a very difficult raid. He was, of course, talking about the San Jose raid, which sailed, in fact, from Falmouth. They congregated in Falmouth. We sent about 30 members of Fire Commando, mainly specialists in demolitions, and that was their job when they got to San Jose. So it formed up in Falmouth and sailed out to Falmouth, and we knew nothing about it. The only person who did know something about it was our colonel, our then colonel, Colonel Sanguinetti, who on our first job afterwards he was sent back to his unit. And so they sailed off to the what we all considered the worst raid of the war, and I think that was proved. They did a terrific job there, and not one of our people came back to Number 5 Commando. They were either killed or taken prisoner, and several of them were wounded. Some people did get back from the San Jose raid, but not a member of 5 Commando. A few months later, after more training, and by then we were very well trained and reliant on one another, taught the importance of answering orders immediately, otherwise it would put our colleagues in danger. Soon after that, after these 11 glorious months in Falmouth, where incidentally I met a girl and we were married, and that's something I must tell you about, because our very first night in Falmouth, me and a colleague were in a lovely billet in Tresillian Road, where we had Cornish pasties the first night. When my Cornish pasty was delivered to the table, I thought I had to carve for a few of them, but it was magnificent. And I've been hung up on Cornish pasties ever since. Unfortunately, in Kingston-on-Thames, which is only 3 miles from here, Cornish pasties made in Cornwall are brought up daily where they're cooked in Kingston and sold. I usually have one a week. Anyway, what happened was that very first night, my colleague and I went out, and we left by the bedroom window to try the fire arrangements, and landed on the lawn in front, much dismay of our new landlady, who was looking out the living room window. And we walked down the town and were accosted by a man who told us the history of Falmouth, about the Falmouth packets, the boats that went out of Falmouth with all the mail, a lot of it from London, which came down by stagecoach or horse. And when we got as far as Falmouth, which is in the, as far as Woolworths, which is in the lovely town, we were stopped by a girl. Now that was most unusual in those days. I mean, most men didn't even like to stop and talk to a girl. But this was a girl who was walking their dog, stopped to talk to us. And I think she was intrigued by our bell morals, which had an orange hackle, because we didn't get green berries until late 1942. When one of the officers at the depot decided we should, commandos should have distinctive headgear. So we were talking to this girl, and she invited us to go home to her mother's and have supper with them, which we did, and which we thoroughly enjoyed. And they told us about Falmouth. We told them about a little about us, not much. And at the end of the evening, we thanked them very much. And I said to the girl, where do you work? And she said, in Woolworths. I said, oh, Woolworths. I said, when I get time off, I'll drop in and thank you again, because we've had a really lovely evening. For some reason, I had next day off, and I don't know why, because I was just a private. And in those days, when you joined a commando, you joined usually as a private and an officer of a second lieutenant. Although there were exceptions, we appointed an RSM from the Coldstream Guards, who was super on the parade ground, didn't see a lot of him in action, and I was eventually to take his place. However, that morning, I walked in Woolworths. That's when assistants served behind their counters, and I asked where she was, and the gossip started. I could hear it going on as I walked down to her, and she was on the very end counter, on the left. And when I go to Falmouth now, I always walk down there. And she was serving a woman who was intent on gossip. And she waved and said, I won't be a moment. And I said, plenty of time, I've got time off. At that moment, another little girl sidled forward, another assistant. Can I help you? I said, no, I'm waiting for Winnie, but as you can see, she's serving. I said, but I'm not in a hurry. Got started talking to her. That was the girl I married, not the first one. And so eventually we moved out of Falmouth. And the interesting thing was that wives could always move with us. We moved to Dartmouth, and my billet then was a marvellous house overlooking the harbour. And the husband, fortunately, was the manager of a grocery shop. So not only did we have a super billet with a lovely view, but also plenty of food. We only stayed there about 3 months, got to know Dartmouth very well. And unfortunately, in my early days there, I helped to move, and I used one of the blankets from the orderly office and got impetigo and had to go into hospital for a week. And my wife was on her own then, but she could look after herself. And then we moved to Bognor, and when we arrived in Bognor, the landlady was a spiritualist, and we went to one or two interesting meetings. And we weren't there long either, but we were issued with white kit bags. And it was obvious we were going east, not knowing where, of course. And soon after that, we entrained again, said goodbye to our wives and lovers, and went on this train and ended up in Scotland, in a well-known place, which I just forget. I've got it now, in Greenock. Got off the train, marched round to the docks, marched into the docks, and then took the first left. And when we took the first left, there in front of us was the SS Winchester Castle, a former luxury liner, but there was something different about it. And the difference was, instead of lifeboats, they were landing craft, army landing craft. So we knew we were due for some landings. It sailed the next day, a massive convoy sailed out across the Atlantic, excuse me, almost to Canada, went down the American coastline to the South Atlantic, and I was then marvelling at navigation, and marvelled more 6 weeks after we sailed, when we saw land again, and it was South Africa. I was very fortunate on that journey, because when we boarded, most privates were given jobs to do. We had plenty of time off, some for training, some for leisure, and my job was in what was called the kitchen. It wasn't a kitchen, in fact. It was where the food and tea was served from. And when I arrived in there, the person in charge, the merchant navy man in charge, was in fact a man from the same road that I lived in East Molesey. So I had a super job, got all the rations I needed. And we landed in Durban, a super town, and where we made ourselves sick with chocolate, which we hadn't eaten for a long time, and also pineapples. Now, as you know, pineapples were pretty prickly, and everybody got home back on board with sore lips. We spent about 4 days there, and it was really gorgeous. Once we marched out to Zululand and marched back again, that was interesting. And because we were suffering from sea legs, and we had to get fit again. And while we were doing that, oh, the favourite drink there wasn't beer, it was Pimm's Number One, for some reason or other. We were all looking forward to beer. Eventually we got on board, and we sailed in this enormous convoy, which included a ship, a naval ship I'd never seen before, a Monitor. It was no longer made, a very large battleship with one massive gun on board, ideal as a prelude to landings. And enormous naval convoy, and I knew that we were going to be well supported. I was looking forward to action, like all the young men were. And we sailed, and by then some nurses had joined us, Queen Mary Alexander Nursing Corps, and they were obviously accompanying us. And we eventually sailed, still not knowing where we were going, although all the South Africans seemed to know where we were going, and they said Madagascar. It was Madagascar. The reason was that one or two Japanese two-man subs had been seen moving in, and as the South Africans were one of our strongest alibis, the days of General Smuts, they were afraid that if the Japs were moving in, they would soon be bombed. And we were there to sort them out. Madagascar then was managed by the Vichy French. You probably know the Vichy French were the people ruling in France, based in Vichy, that's how they got their name. And Madagascar was Vichy controlled, and so we needed to fight them to take it. Foolishly, they decided to fight. I couldn't believe it, because if you'd have seen our task force, which included one aircraft carrier as well as all the battleships. Anyway, we sailed, and it took about another 48 hours because Madagascar is alongside the southeast coast of South Africa, quite close to South Africa. And we were then told what was happening. There was maps and a sand table showing us the harbour, marvellous harbour, the second largest natural harbour in the world. And we were due to land at 4:30 one morning. We knew exactly what we had to do. Excuse me, I've got a cough again.